Okay, so it is September 29th, 2023 in the archives, and I am interviewing Alan Levy for the, Dr. Alan Levy for the Rock Voices Project. Hello, Dr. Levy.
Hello.
All right, so first off, could I get some biographical information? Like your name, where you're from originally, your education, things like that.
Okay. My name is Alan Levy. I was born in Mount Vernon, New York, right outside New York City. I graduated from Washington and Jefferson College in the same area as this. Total coincidence, they ended up back here. But I went to WJ as an undergraduate. From there I did my master's and PhD at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. I taught for 2 years after my PhD at the University of Wisconsin. I taught for 2 years thereafter at the University of Louisville in Kentucky on a sabbatical placement. And then I taught for 2 years at a prep school in New England called Phillips Exeter Academy. And then in 1985, I came to Slippery Rock.
All right, and how did you originally discover Slippery Rock? Like, what's your affiliation with the place?
It came at the time of my appointment. I learned of the job availability. I remember it was April of 1985. An individual named Robert Stackman chose to retire rather late in the year, so it was a last minute kind of application process. But I was flexible at that point, and so I sent my application in and ended up with an interview on the campus in July of that same year, 1985. And it seemed to go reasonably well, and I was hired and I took the job.
All right, so you started at the fall semester?
August 85, yes.
Okay. And you were here, let's see, if you started in 85, it was already university when you got there, so you weren't really present for any of like the transitions from college to university, or were you, if you remember anything about
it? No, it was already Slippery Rock University. It had just become that 2 years before. It was at the point when I became a faculty member that the leadership of the university had switched from a man named Reinhardt to Ebersold, who was a famous name on the campus. He became the president in November of that very fall.
All right, and you were hired into the history department, right?
Correct.
So did the department you were hired into change while you were here, and if so, how?
It changed 100%. I mean, all the people who were on the faculty when I came have long since retired and sadly some of them have passed away. The chair of the department then is still alive at age 92, bless him. And he lives in the area. His name is Donald Kelly. You should interview him. He knows the history of the school and the history of Butler County and the history of particularly Native Americans in Western Pennsylvania, as well as anyone, anywhere.
Mm. All right, I will keep that in mind, because that's a good idea. What buildings did you work in during your time here?
Spots.
Mm-hmm. The whole time?
The whole time.
All right, and when you first got here, what were your first impressions of the university?
When I first started to teach, or even the first time I arrived, I was on the campus, or both?
Both.
I knew of Slippery Rock, of course, at that point. It was an amusing little story, if you want me to explain it.
Please do.
That Slippery Rock's name had been coming up at various times in the various little news items in the country, particularly related to sports. I'll tell the story as briefly as I can. It was in the fall of 1984 when the name resurfaced. There's the famous story, of course, that sort of goes on where Slippery Rock's football scores are announced at halftime at the University of Michigan, at the University of Texas, at the Air Force Academy, at the University of Colorado. They name, you know, Notre Dame versus Purdue or Iowa versus Wisconsin, whatever big scores there are, and then everyone will cheer. And then at the end of the litany of scores, they announce at these big stadiums, and Slippery Rock defeated Clarion, etc., and everybody cheers. That apparently had started as a tradition in Michigan. Now, the fame of Slippery Rock carries forth because of that tradition. It goes back, I believe, to 1937 when Michigan was named number one, but they had lost to Ohio State. And Ohio State, therefore, should be number one, but they lost to Youngstown State. Therefore, Youngstown State should be number one, but Youngstown State lost to Slippery Rock. And Slippery Rock's undefeated. Therefore, Slippery Rock should be number one. That's where the tradition came, more like that. That same fall, then, many of it, 1984, Brigham Young started out, the school Brigham Young started out the year, this will get me back to Slippery Rock, it'll take a few minutes. Slippery Rock was playing on their own, but Brigham Young started the season against the University of Pittsburgh. Pitt was highly touted before the season began, and Brigham Young beat them. So they ended up, again, like number eight in the country after the first week of games. And then from there, Brigham Young went into their usual fall schedule, playing some lackluster teams like Montana, New Mexico. Because they beat a highly touted Pitt team in the first game, and they ended up in the top 10, they were like number eight or number nine, then as they went through their schedule undefeated, they began gradually to bump up in the schedule as anyone above them lost a game. Turned out that year, everybody lost at least one game. So that miraculously, after beating Pitt, who turned out to be a dud, they were like 3-8 that year. They didn't even make a bowl. So their defeat at Pitt at the beginning of the season really didn't mean anything. But they made the top 10 list. And then after the season was over, they were the only number one team, so they ended up being ranked number one going into bowl games. There were no playoffs in bowl games in those years. It was just invitations. The Big Ten would play the Pac-10 in the Rose Bowl, etc. And in the postseason, Brigham Young was under scrutiny because everybody was saying, you gotta play somebody good in the postseason. They accepted an invitation to the Holiday Bowl, a very lackluster December 24th, Christmas Eve game. And they played a very undistinguished University of Michigan that year, who did not win the Big Ten, who was not going to the Rose Bowl. The coach of Michigan, Bo Schembechler, said to the press, these guys are not that good, meaning Brigham Young. He said, we play better teams. Brigham Young beat them in the Holiday Bowl, 24-17, nothing major. And then on the January 1st day, where the bowl games were played, the big team squared off, and two, I believe it was number two and three of that year, lost their bowl game as well, so it was even more murky. So then the upshot of this comes. On January 2nd, after the bowl games were played, on NBC's The Today Show, Brian Gumbel, himself a sports announcer, who's the host of The Today Show, got word as he's reading the card, we just got news that indeed Brigham Young has been named number one. They pause for a commercial, and you know how sometimes you can hear somebody say something into a microphone thinking that the camera's going off? And so it gets broadcast over national television with Brian Gumbel saying, so who'd they beat, Slippery Rock? That was on January 2nd, 1985.
And that got Slippery Rock into the headlines?
It had already been there, known it because of the amusing nature of the name and all that, so that it was that much more reinforced on me. I knew who Slippery Rock was because of my time in Western Pennsylvania earlier. But it reinforced the old stereotypes. And one of the upshots of that just repeated itself this year, that the 85 season was already set, of course, by that point in January of 85, but for the fall of 1986, Michigan's first game was away. And so they agreed to let Slippery Rock come to the University of Michigan campus and play Wayne State. And something like 50,000 people from Michigan came to the University of Michigan Stadium, which is like 100,000 plus seating capacity. But 50,000 people showed up to watch Slippery Rock beat Wayne State. So the name held some affection in various parts of the country. So that's one of the early memories. This coincided with the beginnings of my time here.
Mm-hmm. Here, I'm going to check the camera real quick.
Sure.
And also,
I hope I'm not shifting around too much.
Not at all. I just needed to make sure I pressed the right button. Now, what about your first visit to the campus?
So my first visit occurred then in the mid-summer, late June, early July of 1985, where I met the was curious because I met with the department, of course, with the chair and the various faculty, and that all seemed to go fairly nicely. Everybody was away at this point because I went again. Reinhardt had left. The new president was to be Ebersole. He was not in town. Ebersole had been what was called the vice president of academic affairs at that point. And he was promoted internally to be president, but he was away. That vice president of academic affairs post is now called the provost. The temporary provost had been the dean of arts and sciences. His name was Charles Zuzak. So he was then the provost, was to become the provost. He was away. And so the replacement dean's name was Roy Stewart, and he was away. So I met the temporary assistant provost, whose name was W.G. Sayer, who had been a chemistry professor. And I met the assistant to the provost, who was there to take care of things, third floor old name, with both the provost and the president away. His name was Louis Rosano. So I met kind of the replacements, up and down the line. But Rosano was a very nice person, and we got along fine in our interview, and Sayer and I had a nice conversation. The department members and I had good conversations in the interviews, and they seemed to enjoy the guest lecture that I gave. So at the end of that day, the head of the search committee of the department was John Nichols, who just retired about 20 years ago. Dr. Nichols told me at the end of those interviews, he said, the job I think is yours. If you want a few days to think about it, let me know. And it turned out that indeed the offer came, so I had to think about it a little bit, but I took the job, and that was it.
Did you say you gave a guest lecture the first day you were there?
That's a demonstration lecture.
What was it about?
It was, since the course then called History 202, the middle of the three surveys that they have still in the Department of History. They've just gone away from it this past year, actually, a two-semester sequence rather than three. Excuse my physical movement here. I gave a lecture that was in effect to be an example of how I would start this 202 course, America 1815 to 1900. And so I gave a demonstration lecture. I always keep my notes. I still got the notes from that day. Jotted down some basic points to cover about where America was politically, socially, and economically in 1815, and what we would then be exploring in this supposed class starting on its first day in History 202.
Okay. Next question on here. What changes have you witnessed at the university, and were they for the better or worse?
Oh, all kinds of changes, of course. The curriculum has gone through many different changes. There's a new one that's been instituted under Rock Studies, as it's called. But is it better, is it worse? Different people's opinions. My opinion doesn't really count because I'm retired. As I always emphasize to my colleagues, who we hire in the next year or so, I was in my last couple of years here. My opinion shouldn't matter. It's your department, just like when I was first here. My opinion about the future of the department was more important than the opinions of anybody who was older and approaching retirement, because those who are going to be here to run things and affect students, they're the people who count, not old blankety blanks like me, because I'm stepping out. The same was the case then 20 years ago, me versus Don Kelly or anybody else. So there's always that dynamic of the new views of people about curriculum and about hiring, what should be emphasized and what should not be. And a lot of that is occurring. I think a big trend that's, I think, manifesting itself right now concerns the way that with funding and the quantity of students coming to Slippery Rock seeming to be a little bit lower, how then hiring is going to be truncated, and how certain departments may be compelled to merge with one another what kind of configurations is this going to lead to? You have no history or political science department, but a kind of department of social sciences involving history, economic sociology, and political science, these kinds of configurations. The devil's in the details with such things. Do we have a humanities department that involves history, philosophy, and English? Do we have a social science department involving history, political science, and economics? You see how you configure it one way or the other. These changes and the talks about them are going on very much, and very much in earnest, as they should be, because how it is to be structured makes a big difference as far as hirings and the ways that disciplines are going to be approached.
All right, and what campus activities were you involved in?
I'd say the main thing I was involved in early on was that I took charge of a nominally existing, but really not, in fact, doing very much honors program. And I took it over and revamped the structure completely because it had been a series of separate courses unto themselves called honors courses. And what I did was restructure so that you had college writing required of all freshmen. And so I had a college writing honor section, had basic history, basic economics, basic courses that had to be taken by students, and had honors sections in those classes so that people could take those honors classes and gain honors credit. But then if they chose to drop out or not pursue the program, the courses still counted in their general impact on their requirements for graduation, so that you can try honors and step in. If you don't like it, step out and not have the work that you did in the honors program count for nothing. So I integrated it more fully with the curriculum of the university. And it seemed to be fairly successful because I was in charge of honors starting in the fall of 1986. By the fall of 1989, when I relinquished, I went off for about a two-year leave in Washington, D.C. to work at the National Endowment for the Humanities temporarily. I turned the program over to John Craig, and by that point we had, when I started, two students in the honors program. In 1989, we had 85 students in the honors program. So it had grown quite a bit. The rocket lists it as two students in 1989. They misprinted it, so people kept saying I didn't build up any students. Yes, I did. The rocket just put 1989 instead of 1986. So it looked like I only had two students after 3 years. I went from 2 to 85.
And I read also in the rocket, because I went back through the old ones, yeah, that you were Grand Marshal for a couple of years. What does that involve?
Some pomp and circumstance. The fun part about it is you stand in front of a whole gathering of students and parents and everybody and say, welcome to Superior graduation, congratulations to everybody. You lead the lines in of all faculty, of all students, you're the first one in, so that you get to be the leader of the whole ceremony, which is fun. One aspect of it that was not fun was that you had to stand there during the entire time you were crossing the stage and shake hands with the president. And behind the president, you were the one then who has to hand the president the diplomas as he or she hands them out and shakes hands. So that you're standing there passing things on. You feel like, have you ever seen the movie Modern Times with Charlie Chaplin? I'd recommend it to you, but he's
doing, actually, this, I love you.
He's doing this very mechanical work and he walks away from the assembly line. Mm-hmm. Still with nervous and anxiety, moving his body around like he's still on the assembly line. You feel a bit like that doing that kind of work with honors. Grand Marshal's post.
Is that the one with the sequence where like there's a dinner and then like something, like a napkin going across his face afterward, like an automated like thing feeding him dinner or something like that?
I think that's elsewhere in the movie. Yeah.
Okay. Now what about your accomplishments during your time as a
I had published one book by the time I started at Slippery Rock. In the ensuing years, particularly from 1997 to 2013, in that time period I published 1, 2, published 8 books from 1997 to the end of 2013. So if you do the math, that's 16 and a half years. March 1997 to December of 2013. It's a little over 8 years, 16 years, and I published 8 books. So that's, I think, a pretty good accomplishment. And the reviews were generally quite good on each of them. So that was done in the context of me devoting virtually every winter break and every summer, as well as a couple of sabbaticals, entirely to Washington. I put myself in Washington, D.C., and going to the Library of Congress and the archives on a daily basis, going through old newspapers and archival material, and assembling the evidence and putting together books on, one was called Government and the Arts, the History of the Debates over the Subject of What Government Should or Should Not Do in Support of the Arts, biography of the composer Edward McDowell, a famous American composer of the late 19th century, several books on American sports, 3 on baseball, 1 on football, the Jackie Robinson story of football segregation and desegregation. It was virtually the same time as baseball, Jackie Robinson, much less publicity. But the NFL was segregated and integrated a year before Robinson integrated the Brooklyn Dodgers. That story hadn't been fully told. And there's a television program that was done about that as well that was based on my book. It was shown on CBS television in 2010, Christmas 2010, February 2011 on CBS and on ESPN. A book about the boxer Floyd Patterson and a 2-volume biography of the congresswoman named Bella Abzug, who was a famous feminist leader in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s. So I got a fair amount written, which is, I always consider it central to what we, as professors, are supposed to do. Of course, we teach, and we serve on committees, and we serve the campus and the community, but we also are supposed to be active in a scholarly capacity, and I took that in earnest and went forth with it.
All right, and during your time teaching, what were your best and worst teaching moments?
That's hard. I cannot really think of a bad teaching moment per se, but there were moments where, as I look back on it, where I could have reached out perhaps more fully to students that appear to be having personal difficulties. It's always tricky business because you have to respect privacy. Yet there are times when you do reach out and you find that a student very much appreciates the extra effort. But you've got to be careful because you don't know what you're intruding onto whatever the preposition is there. It's proper. It's part of the sensitivity of the issue. You tread carefully. So there are ways in which I feel that I could have, would like to believe that if I had interceded more in what I perceived to be some personal issues that someone may be having, could I have made more of a difference? I'd like to think so, but at the same time, you can step into turf that can lead people to become very defensive and not very happy that you've done so. The best experiences I would link up to the way that students have written me and stayed in touch with me and sent me, as they got when I retired, statements in writing saying, I really appreciated your course because I enjoyed this, and this. One student whose mother had been married to Dr. Kelly, the chair of the department, and she is now the daughter of the knew me when she was when I was first here, she was then about 10 years old. It wasn't exactly a teaching moment, but they had me over for dinner, the Kellys did, and I brought a bottle of wine, and as we were just simply serving dinner, I said to this young girl, I said, let me show you precisely how to pour wine. So that the key point is, when you pour it, you turn the bottle just slightly and you're done, so that you don't spill any drops. And when I retired, she wrote me a little note saying, always remember the lesson you taught me on how to pour wine and not spill it. So little lessons like that, you don't think about it, it's so trivial at the time, but yet there, that one little statement to a 10-year-old, and now she's well into her 40s, and she remembers it.
And she can still pour wine?
She can still pour wine without spilling a drop. Mm-hmm. That's important.
Next question. You've mentioned them already, but who were like the leaders when you first came to campus, the people who've been there forever, the people who are really making changes, the first movers and shakers, and what were your impressions of them?
I always try to separate the personal from the professional. Personally, I don't think I had a problem at a personal level with terribly many people. In all my time here, there were a few that maybe had some personal problems with me, I will freely admit that. But I always believed that one should be open and frank and clear about one's beliefs in the pursuit of professional standards in regard to curriculum or scholarship or teaching or anything else. And there were some people on this campus who were intent on, it seemed to me, on showing how important they were by how much influence they had over such matters as curriculum. And in some cases, I detected very little in the way of academic substance that lent any kind of legitimacy or support to their apparent influence that they wielded over such important issues as curriculum. And so what I often did was simply ask what proved to be somewhat uncomfortable questions as to what such and such a person is doing in regard to scholarship. As I say, I wrote 7 books, and some of these people have never wrote a book review, or much less an article, much less a book. And so, challenging the standing, not on a personal level, I don't care what background, or whether they're local, whether they're geographically from California or anywhere else, sort of what race, what religion, what gender, anything else, none of that matters to me, and should that matter to anybody? Do you have something to say that's valid? And in challenging some people in certain respects, I think I ruffled more than a few feathers, and stuck to my guns and had to take on others who wanted to try to diminish the impact that my words were having. And a few people were disturbed about that. But I couldn't let it bother me because I always knew in my own heart that I was never being personal. If I discovered that somebody was claiming to have published an article, other people did this as well, or published a book, and the book didn't exist. It was fairly obvious, when somebody lists a book and the publisher is given, and you can try to look up the publisher, and the publishing house doesn't exist. How can they claim it? Have a book out. So in challenging things like that, I definitely ruffled some feathers and got some people in a little hot water, including some administrators whose positions then with the state as a role of a leader on a campus can be put in jeopardy, because if they approve of such people getting ahead who have such demonstrably unjust levels of attainment, and such obvious levels of dishonesty in what they're posturing about themselves, it's not just that individual who can get in trouble, but it is the administrator that can get in trouble with the powers that be in this chancellor's office or in the attorney general's office even. And some of that did happen as a result of my insisting that such standards be maintained. There was a certain level, how I would describe it, in PowerPoint, when you're back. Going back to your question, what was my impression of these people? My impression was that old slippery rock, as I call it, the old guard names that are long gone. And again, nothing personal here, but these were people who felt that they were sort of the king of the hill. But it was such the Jonathan Swift word, the Lilliputian aspect of it. mean, to be a big shot, that's sort of like, that's, it's neither good nor bad, but it's a pretty tiny universe. And if it was based on standards that were really being corrupted by claiming to publish books that didn't exist, it was valid to challenge it, in my judgment. And if that ruffled feathers internally, I really, again, I wasn't happy to do it, but I wasn't sad to do it either. And if it got certain individuals in trouble for indulging that, I don't think it was a bad thing. And if it made some people have to step away from Slippery Rock University, I don't think the school was worse for it.
On the other hand, who did you work best with, would you say?
Various colleagues would have said, I tend to work best, Levy tends to work best alone. And I was happy in that way too. I did not co-author many pieces. I did not engage in collective research. I wasn't avoiding people, but that was believing that the work of scholarship tends to be an individual pursuit. So I worked with people in hiring committees and curriculum committees and departmental work of various sorts, sure. And I think I got along best with those who shared the view that the standards of what represents good academics should be based on standards that are common to the profession across the country, rather than just more sui generis based on friendship connections and relationships within the community. The two should be in harmony with each other. When they are out of harmony, then the local should yield to the more widely held definitions of content that apply across the board.
All right. And other people who influenced you or were significant during your time here could be students, could be faculty, could be administration.
I think the students that impressed me most and for whom I held the deepest respect were the veterans of the military, the non-traditional students who, while they're raising children or holding down jobs, would also be pursuing their degrees and doing remarkably well in that context. To that end, I very much enjoyed teaching and made a habit of teaching at least one class per semester in the evening, part of the schedule, so that Monday night from 5 to 7:30, or from 5:30 to 8, I would have a class. And in the early years particularly, up until somewhere in the 2000 teens, at least a third of the class would be people who worked full-time or raising children or were coming out of the military or whatever, but were older and were taking on many different other aspects of normal life for a 29-year-old or a 33-year-old, and were yet going through all this while they're coming to campus and pursuing the work involved in an undergraduate curriculum. And so when undergraduates are coming, they're saying, I really don't have time because I got this social event on Tuesday, etc. Can we have a makeup test? Well, these older people out of the military or pursuing professional life and raising children could always come up with excuses for other things they have to do, and taking the kids to the Little League or doing this aspect of the job, etc. They made it very easy for me, not to be harsh, but just simply to turn to these undergraduates of the normal age, 18 to 22, and say to them, I'm not being harsh with you, but I'm just saying, if you've got these other social obligations, do what you have to do to pursue those, because that's part of your life too, but don't let those get in the way of your real education. And the example I could always point to, look what your colleagues are doing. In just recounting some of these examples, one student certainly sticks out in this regard because he was blind and took an evening class with him. And he had to make certain arrangements, but it was also easy because he had children and they would come to class on the night of tests. And I would give his son a copy of the test. They would go off to the library. So he'd need a little extra time to go forth with it. But on test night in a 5 to 7:30 class. The test would run from 5 to 6:15. They'd have the questions, the test back to me by then, 15 minutes off. Then we'd meet for the last hour of that 2.5 hour evening, introducing some of the material of the new unit. So he always got his test handed in. The method that by which he took it was that there were multiple choice in an essay section, and his son would read the multiple choice questions to him, and he would choose A, B, C, or D, and his son would break them down. And then his son would read the essay questions, and he would sit at the computer and try to get an answer. And so I'd get the answers and essay from him, and it was just as valid as in the content of what I got from others, and where I particularly remember, in addition to the fact that he, despite obvious, huge disability, you don't have to call it a handicap anymore, he actually got never mind the use of the word, despite his disability, he went forth with the material and finished it, and did very well. And what was particularly moving was, once a semester, I've had each of the students in the class of about 50, either in the three units, and then the first unit, second unit, and third unit, class would be divided into four groups, and on report night, with say, in a class of 50, so about 10 to 15 students per group, and a third of each unit would report in the first unit, second unit, third unit. Everybody gives a one oral report and hands in a written report on a subject pertaining to the first third of the chronology, the second or third of the chronology of the class. And he chose his topic and prepared a report. And so he gives a little 15-minute presentation to the class on that night. And normally after a student gives a report, everybody in the class, they're polite assistants. And when the student who was blind gave his report, and when he was done, you could just feel the heart that was there among the students. And it brings out a level of emotion in me right now just to think about them. They really did applaud, you know, and in it with a tonality that was quite unusual, because they all appreciated who he was as well. And it didn't take a genius to figure out why. But that was a very special time. Other memories that are not quite so gut felt, but nonetheless important. There were a couple of times where I had parents, one in particular, but there were others, who brought their children to class or had their kids sitting in the hallway, or I didn't give them a place to relax, but they would be sitting there in the hallway with their computers, typing away at things while mom was sitting in class. That was always good fun. And a couple of students I always enjoyed the fact that they wanted to bring their dog to class. And, so we had a couple of class puppies during evening classes. That was always fun too. So that all those little variations were there throughout. They kind of dot the landscape as I think back on it. 38 years is going to have a lot of detail like that that stick in the mind.
next question on the paper here is, major events and activities while you were here? Like building projects, cultural things, national events with local impact?
One that pops into my mind extraordinarily, of course, was 9/11. Mm-hmm. It was a Monday, and I remember several things about it. It was a day like, much like today. I mean, it's September of 2001 as opposed to 2024. But it was a day with an absolutely glorious clear blue sky. And I remember I went to the gym early in the morning, went out jogging, and came back. The rec center had just opened, I believe, the previous year. And I came in from my jog outside and saw a bunch of people gathered around the TV. I said, what's going on? And at that point, only one of the two towers of the World Trade Center had been hit. And everybody was talking, what's going on here? And while I came in and was watching, that was when the second plane hit the tower. And all through that day, you know, people gathering into classrooms where the professor would tune the news in to the computer to be able to show what was going on. And so we nominally had class, but at the same time, our attention was elsewhere. And it was a not disturbing, but a little bit, what caused a little bit of lament in my mind was the fact that the campus officials seemed to be a little bit slow in reacting. Some students and faculty got busy putting messages up through chalks, through sidewalk chalkings, which was then is now a method of disseminating information, and we had a gathering in front of the library. We didn't have one until Friday night of that same week. I thought the campus was a little slow officially to react. A gentleman named G. Warren Smith, whom I liked very much, was at that point the president, and he tended to be a little bit less dynamic, a little more slow to react to things than I think it was called for at that point. But certainly the turnout in front of the library was still pretty good, and so people were anxious to somehow show involvement and concern. That was certainly a major event. That would be the major one that pops into my mind, certainly.
What about building projects specifically? Because if you've been here since the 80s, you would have seen a lot of like the campus around us sort of pop up.
Yeah, because when I was first here, Swope Music Hall was about, you know, that was the end of the campus, aside from the football field. There was nothing beyond there. There was a kind of a high-rise dormitory called Founders that was in that new dormitory area where Watson Hall and everything down there would be built later. Aside from that tall, older student dormitory, there's nothing east of Swope. There's no Abersalt Recreation Center, none of those new dormitories. There's no baseball field, there's no soccer field. It was just open grass area. The old timers of the day, of course, talked about how going back into the 1950s and 60s, it was even more starkly contrasting because the campus basically stopped at the field house. There was no Vincent, there was no Swope, there was no Eisenberg. So that I kind of came to at the point of this sort of second phase of that expansion. So all those new dorms, the baseball field, maturing in the greater use as athletic facility rather than just open fields, all the sports areas that are up on top of the hill, where Princeton Road and Harmony Road crisscross, and all those baseball fields. That was just open space back then. We used to go out there and shoot it as a driving range and hit golf balls. Now there were softball and baseball fields and rugby fields all over the place. But it used to be so much more just wide open space. We always advertised that we had more acreage than any other campus, which we do in the state system. But particularly in the 1980s and before, much of that acreage was just wide open grassy areas. So much of that has been developed now. That's a big change, and for the good, I think.
And any other big memorable events you can think of?
Certainly, it's still, that always keeps popping in my head because it was such a day when so much came crashing home. We've had no events like the ones that stick in my mind that have happened on other campuses. In 2006, when you had the shooting at Virginia, what we used to call VPI, Virginia Polytechnic Institute, the Virginia Tech shootings of 2006 kind of reinforced to me, fortunately it hasn't come true, that such possibilities can be present in regard to a campus like Slippery Rock as they can be anywhere. It can happen at Virginia Tech, it can happen at SRU. It was a lesson I drew from it. And I tried to say that to various administrators over the years. And we've got to be not on our guard and scour the dormitories for any hints of a weapon or any kind of plottings, but don't ever think that we're immune from it, because again, if it happened in Blacksburg, Virginia, in the middle of the north of the Allegheny, of the eastern slope of the Allegheny Mountains, it can happen in Silver Rock, Pennsylvania, on the western slope of the Allegheny Mountains. It's the same longitude, but it's not downtown Philadelphia or downtown New York, but it's the countryside, but matters happen there at DPI, and make it happen here too. And so it's not a positive memory, but it's a very real one, and I think it's something we have to maintain.
Sounds like you've been retired for a couple of years now. What, if anything, do you miss about?
I just retired in May.
Oh, okay. Good to know. What, if anything, do you miss about being here?
Whatever I could articulate as far as what I miss would translate back into me saying, gee, I wish I was 39 years old again and had the strength and energy of a 39-year-old. I used to live in a very, I still try to be athletic every day and do something, as my sloppy clothes indicate. I try to do some kind of workout all the time to maintain health. Back then I did it vastly more and did it in connection with work I was doing. What do I mean by that? When I would go to the Library of Congress, etc., I would get there early in the morning when the library would open. 7:45, I would work all day, take maybe 20 minutes for lunch, and then work until about 3:30, and then pack up with my note card, etc., in one of those side fanny packs we used to call them. And from there, I lived in DuPont Circle, and most of my time in Washington, and would jog from the Library of Congress down the length of the wall from the Capitol Building to past the Washington Monument to Lincoln Center, and up Rock Creek Park, past Connecticut Avenue, and come back out near DuPont Circle, just north of Adams Morgan, and jog down to the Hilton Hotel, where I had a membership, and then do some swimming, so that I would pile athletics on top of research and do the same thing while I would teach here, go jogging before or after a day of teaching. The point is I miss doing that, but I don't have the strength to do that anymore. I'm 71 years old. So when I say, what do I miss having that kind of energy? Well, that's another way of saying I wish I was 35 and not 71. Duh, who doesn't wish that? Nobody likes to be 71 as opposed to 35, but that's life.
How would you like to be remembered by the community here? Or do you have an opinion on that?
Yeah, I do. I'd like to be remembered as someone who was what he genuinely presented himself to be, an active scholar, a genuinely concerned teacher who tried to approach material that he taught and wrote about with a level of integrity, and who let the record speak for itself as far as how the students and colleagues reacted to what he wrote and what he taught and how he served.
All right, and last question for you. Do you have any words of wisdom for current or future Rock community members?
Be yourself. Whatever you obviously, whatever. When I taught at Phillips Exeter Academy, there was a living in a dormitory coaching sports, and being a local parent in effect for students as well as teaching, I always said to people, whatever you try to hide that you don't want people to know about, they'll somehow detect, the members of the community will detect the sense of hiding something. And whatever you put up as a kind of front that isn't you, they'll see through it. And this precious thing we have called life doesn't really last that long. Make the most of it. And so be who you are. Find out what it is you want to do and pursue that. So if it's teaching, great. If it's not, that's okay too. But be yourself and pursue that to the nth degree. There's a lot of time to do it. 70 years sounds like a long time to you, but I wish I had 70 more. I don't. Nobody does.
Great. That's all I have for questions. Thank you so much.
I hope it went well.